Our next case for argument is 22-1080, Calapristi v. United States. Mr. McKinley, when you're ready.
If it please the court. I'm going to warn Your Honor, I have a tendency when I get nervous to talk quickly and talk loudly. And last time I was in front of this court, I was perceived as screaming at the court.
The answer is don't be nervous.
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. And Judge Lori asked me to calm down and quiet down. And I didn't even realize I was doing it. So if you could give me the same courtesy again if I happen to make that same mistake. There's a lot of cases, beginning with Cienega Gardens and running through Turping v. U.S., that has held that no amount of control that the government exercises over a contract, say between a contractor and a subcontractor, or a contractor and its employees, that there's no amount of control that can create privity. And I don't think that decision, I don't think that line of argument and that reasoning is worthy of this court. I would point out that there is no analogous case by the Supreme Court. There is no analogous case by any of your sister circuits. There is no analogous case by any of the state Supreme Courts. No other court.
The government wasn't a party to this contract, was it?
I believe the government was a party to this contract, Your Honor, because what the government did was they ordered their contractor to set up this pension system, and then they smuggled a provision into the pension plan that the government had complete control over.
What are you talking about? They smuggle, are you talking about Article 29?
I am.
Well, who smuggled what? And what does smuggling mean?
Smuggling means they put the plan together and they put a provision in it that purports to be controlled by the plan administrator, but it was never going to be controlled by the plan administrator. It was always going to be controlled by the government, and in fact, it was controlled by the government.
Well, wait a minute. So let's be specific. Judge Lurie asked you. I mean, the government wasn't a signatory to this. It was the employer, right?
That's true.
And the only reference to the government in the entire document is this Article 29, right?
Correct.
Only reference. And the reference to the government is a termination for transfer, or is the termination from one contractor to another, which is determined to be in the best interests of the government.
Correct.
So that's control? I mean, what does that get you in terms of the government being a signatory or party to this contract?
Well, the government's making a promise, or the pension plan is making a promise. And it's making a promise that a specific thing is going to happen when there's a termination for transfer. Now, what you have to recognize is mechanically, when there's a termination for transfer, there is no contractor. The contractor that the employees work for is leaving. So they have no duties going forward.
Right.
They certainly have no duty to make sure that the employees continue to accrue their credit for their years of service at the Hanford site.
So what happened as a factual matter here? So the new contractor comes in and says, I'm not going to abide by the terms of these previous contracts with other employers.
It was worse than that. It was far worse than that. The new contractor came in and proposed to the government, hey, let's breach that provision. Let's breach Article 29 in their proposal to the government. When the government solicited the following contract, in the solicitation, they required that you honor Article 29. The new contractor made a proposal to the government that said, hey, let's not honor it. Excuse me. But not for everybody. Let's just not honor it for this small group of employees that we'll call enterprise employees.
And you're saying that the government, based on the language of Article 29, was obligated to do what? To require the new contractor to sign along the lines of the obligations of the former contractors, or that the government itself is, in any event, liable for all of these monies that were lost by the employees, or what?
The obligation in Article 29 is that when there's a termination for transfer, you won't truncate the employee's accrual of years of service.
But then the new contractor comes in and doesn't sign that, right? Is that what I'm just, these are innocent questions. I'm just trying to get clear what the facts are.
Let me get to it, because the facts are convoluted. What happens is they propose that we truncate those benefits for the enterprise companies.
Who's they?
The successor contractor. The government agrees to that. So then the enterprise company employees no longer have a sponsoring employer in the plan. Their new employer in the new set of contracts is not a part of the plan. So immediately...
Well, that's key, isn't it? The new employer who isn't abiding by, what is that, Article 29, isn't in this case. Now, there's sort of an aroma of unfairness here, but the problem is you've sued the government.
And the government is liable, and I'll explain why. Because this gets to privity.
Yes, but my big concern is that you litigated all of these issues already in Turpin versus United States, and we decided that you were wrong. There was no privity, no implied in fact contract, and we considered every argument you just made with regard to Article 29 in that exact decision. So what you came along here to do in an attempt to cure it is you filed a few new allegations like the Vodny Declaration and a few other pieces, but I haven't heard you rely on a single one of those as you stand here. Every word that seems to have come out of your mouth today is identical to what was already argued and already decided against you. So where in this record did you make new allegations that should cause us to ignore binding precedent on this court in Turpin?
Your Honor, in Turpin, this court recited that there is, quote, no evidence that the government intended to be contractually obligated to Lockheed's other employees, either through the MEP or by other means. And if I can finish, I'll provide you with that evidence. I think that evidence was there in Turpin.
But it doesn't matter what you think. And it actually doesn't even matter what I think about what was present in Turpin. It's a binding decision on me, correct?
Well, it's binding if you have the same facts before you. But
you just said, I think what was present in Turpin was enough. Could I hold what was present in Turpin was enough? Do you understand the concept of precedent?
I do, Your Honor.
Could I hold what was present in Turpin alone was enough?
Well, the difficulty that we have is that Turpin recites a set of facts that I disagree. I think a different set of facts are in the complaint in Turpin. Now,
well, you had an opportunity for petition for rehearing and to make your case. At some point, you did, but you didn't prevail on a petition for rehearing. So at some point, precedent is precedent, and you have to move on. And I thought you at least were trying to do that in this case, as the Chief suggested, by coming in with an amended complaint and more different types of allegations. Am I missing something?
I believe you are, Your Honor.
Okay.
If I could just be allowed to get through this last set of facts.
Okay.
When the government terminated and transferred in 1996, they then unilaterally rewrote the pension plan. The pension committee, the plan administrator, attempted to tell the enterprise company employees that they were no longer part of the pension plan. And they said, great. And they said, okay, ERISA allows us to draw our pensions now. And they started drawing their pensions. And the government said, hey, hold on a minute. We can't have that. We can't have you drawing your pensions while you're continuing to work at the Hanford site. You know, the optics are bad. So the government went in and said, no, you're not out of the plan. They overruled the plan administrator. They said, you're not out of the plan. You're going to remain in the plan. And we're going to rewrite the pension plan to give you the high five benefit. Okay? So this is where the government directly involves itself and directly does so in a way that creates privity between itself and these employees. Because the government says, we're going to give you a high five benefit. And they proceed to do so. And they proceed to, and because they give them the high five benefit, the government has to make contributions to the plan. And they have done so for 26 years. Now, what ties the government to that obligation? Nothing. Nothing but the MEP. That's it. The only reason the government is making those contributions into the pension plan on behalf of those employees is because of the language in the MEP. Because okay. remember, there's no employer.
Am I wrong, or is this the same or a similar argument that was present in Terping?
I think it's a court that in Terping the court did not appreciate, and so I think it's a new argument.
It was an argument that was made in Terping and that was rejected by the court when it drew its conclusions. I really think you would benefit yourself if you would focus on the new allegations and the new evidence you presented. You have some allegations regarding the Vodny Declaration and the DOE Order 3830, which I think were not present in the Terping case. I don't see how I can revisit the arguments you made in Terping and that the court rejected in a precedential decision. So I think you would really benefit yourself with only 5 minutes remaining for all of your time if you would focus on the arguments that I'm not bound to reject because of precedent.
Your Honor, I think that you're tied to the precedent in Terping, and you're tied to the idea that no amount of control creates privity, but I do think you can find an exception, and I think you can find an exception when the government actually involves itself in a manner where it creates a direct relationship between itself and those third parties. And that's what happened here in this case. The new evidence is basically explaining evidence that in the Terping opinion said, the Terping opinion said wasn't present. The Terping decision said that the agency argument didn't prevail. Well, that argument wasn't really relevant. The Vodny Declaration establishes that it was the government that set up the MEP, that it wasn't, it wasn't done by an agent. It was the government's acting as its principal that created the MEP. The the policy of the government shows that they intended to control the MEP the entire time.
So I'm not understanding the theory. You started by saying that we should create an exception to Terping. How would you articulate that exception?
The exception would be, generally speaking, in the line of cases beginning with Sienega Gardens and going through Terping, generally speaking, government interference doesn't create privity. Now, the court has stated that as something of a tautology. And, it's true unless it's not true. And in this case, it's not true. Because in this case, the government interference did create privity, because it did create a direct relationship between the government and the plaintiffs that has as its only basis, because there's no employer intermeeting between the two anymore. The government is paying into the MEP on behalf of these people, and their employer is completely out of the picture as a result of the contract changeover. So now there is privity. I mean, privity just means there's a relationship, and there's definitely a relationship. They're paying money into the MEP for 26 years on their behalf. So
Counsel, respectfully, what does privity mean? Privity does not mean there's a relationship. There are a lot of things that qualify as a relationship that don't establish privity under the law.
Privity is actually a slippery contract concept to nail down when you try and look it up and read about it. I would ask the court, tell me what the court interprets privity to me, and I can explain why it's here.
I think you have a fundamental misunderstanding about this process.
I do, Your Honor. Privity means that there's a relationship between the two parties where they're bound to each other. If the government's not bound to these plaintiffs, why is it paying money into their pension fund for 26 years? Is it just charity? The government appears to believe that it's bound, and the case that sits over top of all of this, of course, is Baltimore and Ohio, a meeting of the minds, which, although not embodied in an express contract, is inferred as a fact from the conduct of the parties, showing in light of the surrounding circumstances their tacit understanding. Well, if you look at what the government's doing, their tacit understanding is they're responsible to pay for the high five benefit for these plaintiffs, which shows that, contrary to everything the government's about to say, they understand that they're bound to these plaintiffs through the MEP. Otherwise, okay. Why are they making those payments?
Well, you've used almost all your time. Why don't we hear from the government and see if they do say that or not? Let's see what they say. How do I say your name, counsel?
Irossi.
Mr. Irossi, please proceed. Why don't you start right where he left off?
Certainly, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'd like to clarify one thing that Mr. McKinley has repeatedly stated here today. He said it in his brief, in his reply brief at page 8. He said in his opening brief at page 13, he claims that the government, through the Department of Energy, has contributed money into the pension plan for 26 years. For these enterprise company employees for their high five benefits. It's patently false. I know that the court has to accept allegations complaint as true. However, in the Turpin argument at the 25 minute and 50 second mark, after I had pointed out.
Are you sure it was 25 minutes?
That's when the conversation starts, Your Honor. Absolutely.
25 minutes,
I wrote it
how
down.
How many seconds?
50. 25, 50. Okay. So I had pointed out to the court that there's never been one red cent paid from the U.S. Treasury directly into the pension plan. Rather, as is the case all the time, the Department of Energy would pay the contractors working on the Hanford Reservation for the work they performed. Any allowable costs that go towards pension plans are eventually, you know, paid into the plan from the contractors, from the government contractors, never the agency. And Mr. McKinley recognized, admitted, yes, it's true that the money never goes from the Treasury to the pension plan, but rather DOE pays its contractors, and they have to fund the pension plan. It would be like saying that the U.S. Treasury pays Northrop Grumman shareholders dividends because we pay Northrop Grumman as part of their government contracts. That's not true. So certainly it's true that the enterprise companies had, or the enterprise company employees had this high five benefit, and the employers that are working on the Hanford Reservation have to include that cost as part of their allowable pension costs. And the Department of Energy pays those costs. But it's not that the government is somehow separately has a side agreement with these enterprise company employees to pay for these costs.
Do you agree that in this scenario, it seems like there's some pretty significant unfairness, but that possibly that unfairness is not to be borne by the government? Is that a fair statement? Do you think everything worked exactly as it should have for all of these employees and these employers, these government contractors?
Your Honor, I believe that the enterprise company employees think that they were aggrieved somehow, and they think that they were treated unfairly. It's not part of the record. I hesitate to mention it, but the whole reason these enterprise companies were created was because everyone at Hanford worked for the federal government, and there was an effort to diversify the workforce. These enterprise companies were going to seek commercial work outside of the government. And so as part of that process, they wanted to they were not going to take part in the pension plan. And the employers at the time in 1996, when the termination for transfer took place, they were told this. So ultimately, they lost out on the ability to continue to accrue service time as a result of this process. You know, the new prime contractor was the one who suggested, according to the complaints allegations, that we're going to have this special system, and there's going to be some employers who are going to try and diversify, and they're going to not be part of the pension plan. But that's not the Department of Energy's I don't say problem, but that didn't create some sort of privity or, you know, contract between the Department of Energy.
So even if those employees really were completely disadvantaged in this process, it doesn't inure to the government, it inures to their employer.
Certainly. The plaintiffs in this case could have sued their employers, Lockheed Martin's, the enterprise companies. They could have brought them into court, they could have sued them, they could have sued the plan administrator.
Under what theory?
Well, I mean, They had the opportunity to articulate a theory saying somehow that they should have, you know, received pension benefits, whether it was in district court or somewhere else. They never brought suit. There's never been any, as far as I know,
They're all separate employers. I mean, you're right. Anything is possible, but I don't see that they would have had a theory. So their common thread through all of this is the government. So you can understand why that would sort of stick out as the only way to recoup what they think they were entitled to.
Certainly. This case is complicated because you have this 92-page multi-employer pension plan document, but that's not the contract that the plaintiffs here allege is between the United States and the plaintiffs. Mm-hmm. They only allege an implied contract. They base it on one paragraph of this 92-page document, Article 29, and they say based upon this, the recitations in that one paragraph, the government promised at a termination of transfer to guarantee certain pension benefits, or that their service
time
would continue.
Can I ask you, what is the differential ballpark figure between when they were getting accrued years of service being accrued and the payments that would result in their pensions and that versus the high five thing?
Your Honor, I have no idea. We haven't had discovery. The plaintiffs allege in their complaint that there's $100 million in damages. I don't know if that's just...
And how many employees are at...
I think there are maybe a couple of thousand. I don't think there's more than a couple of thousand, but it's certainly in the hundreds. Plaintiff's counsel, I'm sure, would be able to let you know exactly. But I think the key to this case is to recognize that this panel does not write on a blank slate. As Chief Judge Moore mentioned, Turpin sets forth a roadmap for how to analyze this situation. And the plaintiffs, by their own admission, at pages 27 to 28 of their opening brief, say that we have alleged additional facts that somehow should distinguish Turpin from this case. And they include these facts based on a misreading of the last footnote in the Turpin case, where the court said that there's not enough information about control or agency. And so the plaintiffs here included these four sets of new facts: the Vanya Declaration, the DOE Order 3830, the transfer agreement, and the press releases to show control. The problem, though, is that, as Plaintiff's counsel mentioned when he was speaking, it's black-letter law that no matter the level of control that an agency exercises in a project, that doesn't create privity of contract. The Ciénaga Gardens case is a perfect example of that. In that case, the court said HUD's intimate involvement with all aspects of the agreement it was irrelevant. HUD conceived the structure of the transaction, prescribed and approved all of the relevant documents, including the mortgage note and its rider, and furnished most of the specific language. Despite that heavy control, the heavy pen that HUD allegedly exerted in that case, this court rightly concluded that that control was not relevant, didn't create privity. In this case, all of the four new sets of facts that the plaintiff raises in his brief and raises in his complaint, the Vanya Declaration, the order, the transfer agreement, the press releases, by their own admission, go to the issue of control. They wanted to show there really was control here. But again, it's irrelevant. Even if the court were to admit, the court in Turpin specifically said that, talked about and cited to the allegation that the contractors couldn't make any changes to the pension plan, they couldn't do anything without the Department of Energy's permission, and still concluded that there wasn't privity of contract. Because control itself does not equate to an intent to contract. The court should remember here that the Turpin plaintiffs, as well as the plaintiffs in the trial court below here, their complaint was dismissed because there was no evidence of an intent by the Department of Energy to contract with employees of a government subcontractor. And so they needed to come into court with a complaint that showed evidence by the Department of Energy to contract. And their theory is that, well, if there's enough control, then there must have been intent to contract. And that's not what this court's case law says.
Turpin did deal with the concept of control, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. The site that I just read from Ciénaga Gardens was included in the Turpin case. In Turpin, this court said, quote, "The same is true for appellant's focus on the government's alleged control in the creation and administration of the MEPP. Our case law has made clear that the degree of government involvement with a project does not create privity between the government and a subcontractor so as to allow suit against the government." And they gave other examples from the complaint in that case as to how control had been evidenced in the Turpin complaint and said it was insufficient. The fact that there's more evidence of control doesn't negate the fact that control is not enough. And as
I think that their argument hinges on they thought that the Turpin court left open the possibility for a different set of facts on control potentially being enough, and they tried to mount such a set of allegations here. And they, I think that they grounded this argument in footnote 2 from Turpin. If that's not the proper way for us to understand footnote 2 in Turpin, can you tell us what you think footnote 2 in Turpin actually stands
so,
for? Am I right about their argument as you understand it?
I think that's right, Your Honor. The plaintiffs have argued that footnote 2 was somehow a flag, to the parties in that case that had there only been a little bit more information about control, then this case would have been different. It seems odd that the court would have relegated such an important point, like a case dispositive issue, to a footnote at the very end of the opinion. And I disagree with the reading of that, that footnote, that somehow if there was evidence of more control, then the case would have turned out differently. The court in footnote 2 did talk about acting as the government's agent, but or whether the government contractor in creating the multi-employer pension plan acted as the government's agent. However, a few moments ago, plaintiff's counsel admitted, and he did so in his briefs before this court, that they're not alleging an agency relationship here. Perhaps the Federal Circuit in footnote 2 was referencing this notion of agency, and maybe if there was enough evidence regarding an agency theory, maybe the court would have come to a different conclusion. I think that's a very generous reading of the footnote. But in any regard, plaintiff's counsel admits that they're not alleging an agency relationship. He said it's the government acting as principal in this case in creating the pension plan back in 1987.
Footnote 2 has what looks to me like two distinct points in it. The first you just dealt with, but the second it begins, likewise, appellants cannot support their broad allegation that only the government, a non-party to the MPP, had the authority to enforce Article 29 and compel subcontractors to remain in the MEEP. So what if they could support that? What if now they had not just allegations, but what if they put forth allegations and evidence that showed that the government could compel contractors to remain in the MEEP? Would that change the nature of whether this is an implied contract?
No, they haven't done that in this case. The complaint doesn't have those sorts of allegations. And moreover, it's an odd reading of that footnote, because no one but the Department of Energy can control which contractors work on the Hanford Reservation. Of course, that's not a dispute. When the Department of Energy issues a request for proposal and gets, you know, quotes from different government contractors, no one else but the agency and the government is going to select which particular employees come to work for the government. But that doesn't translate into an intent by the agency to enter into a contract. So remember that it's not the multi-employer pension plans that the contract. There's, according to the complaint's allegations, it's this amorphous implied in fact contract that's based on only part of the pension plan, only Article 29, and the government had an obligation apparently to only select particular government contract. It's hard to articulate because honestly it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But the fact that even if
their argument or our footnote?
No, the argument. All right, I would never suggest that the court footnote is unclear. It's really an issue of the fact that they misread the footnote, but even if they didn't misread the footnote, you want to credit them. None of the new evidence in this case, as the trial court recognized,
meets that standard.
That's correct. Anything further? Two things, Your Honor.
One,
we also raised in our brief the issues of the other three contractual elements, consideration, acceptance, and offer acceptance and authority. We think that those are independent reasons for affirming the court's judgment. And lastly, on a somewhat personal note, I want to thank the faculty and the students of Penn for hosting us today. I think that Penn is the greatest law school in the country, and I say that only partially because I'm a graduate. And in fact, 20 years ago, I was a student in Professor Wagner's patent litigation class, and the Federal Circuit.
Well, you just aged him, didn't you?
I know. The Federal Circuit also had argument when I was a student here, and I had the honor of being a student ambassador for Chief Judge Michelle at the time. And, 20 years later, I'm here arguing from the same court. So I'm very privileged for that. And I thank the court and the folks here for that. There's nothing further.
Yep. Thank you, counsel. You have some rebuttal time.
Your Honor, I think you asked the government an excellent question, that the footnotes and the complaint in Turping that they couldn't support their contention that only the government had the power to do that. But the government admitted that only the government had the power to do that. The government controls the contracts. The government controls whether or not the successor contract is going to continue to give the employees credit for their years of service. And we're talking about 2,000 people were employed under the MEP and then went to work for enterprise companies. My plaintiffs, some of them lost 15 years of service. You multiply that by, they get a job in 87. They move their family to the area. They're promised that if we switch contractors, you're not going to lose your years of service. They buy houses. They send their kids to school. Time passes. All of a sudden, it's 1996. the government pulls the rug out from under them. I mean, this is a massive, massive loss of their benefits that they bargained for, that they were promised. Nobody is arguing that they didn't lose those benefits, and it's a significant amount of money for each of these pensioners. You multiply their final salary times 1.6% times their years of service. So, you know, you're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars for almost all of my plaintiffs. It's real money. And it is unfair. It's completely unfair that they were made this promise. The government made the promise in terms of the government wrote it, and the government forced it to be a part of their contract. You know, no contractor made that decision. The government made that decision. And similarly, in 1996, when it was, you know, rescinded, the government made that decision. Sure, the contractor suggested it, but it was, as Mr. Iorossi noted, the government controls what the contracts say. The government controls the terms and conditions. The government controlled whether or not a successor contractor was going to continue to give them the pension benefit. Now, they don't have an employer at that point.
Okay, counsel,
yeah.
Way beyond your time. Thank you very much for your argument. This case is taken under submission.